Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the weekly podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. So this is it. As a Majlis podcast, we completed our fifth year, and this is our last show for 2018. So congratulations to you. Congratulations to many more who have been part of this journey. So we come a long way together. And as we did during this time, a lot has changed in our region. So in this episode, we are here to discuss highlights from 2018 in Central Asia. Some progress, some step back, some good and some bad news, and what all this might mean for 2019. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Joanna Lillis, Eurasia and its Chief Central Asia Correspondent and the author of the newly released book, Dark Shadows, Inside the Secret World of Kazakhstan. And Lukan Chisti, Central Asia Lecturer at the UK's University of Glasgow and the author of book on Turkmenistan's neutrality. And Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Thank you.
So, Joanna, again, congratulations with the book.
Thank you.
Perhaps this is another big change in your life in regards to Central Asia. So finally, the book is on the market. Did it reach to Central Asia yet?
No. The book at the moment has been published in the UK only at the moment, and it'll be published in North America on the 30th of January. I think some copies have reached Kazakhstan, though, of people who've bought it abroad and taken it back to Kazakhstan to read.
Okay, congratulations. So, you know, its title is kind of little mysterious, Dark Shadows Inside the Secret World of Kazakhstan. So what does that the title mean? Perhaps it has to do with the topic that we are discussing today. So tell us, please, a little bit about the book.
The title itself, I mean, Kazakhstan's not a secret, perhaps, but I think the point of the title is that to the Western reader, it's quite impenetrable, a bit enigmatic. Obviously, to me, I've lived in Kazakhstan for 13 years, so it's not a secret. And, you know, the government doesn't make a secret out of what's going on in Kazakhstan always. But the point is to give a glimpse of life and what life is really like in Kazakhstan for the Western reader, so that the Western reader can get a picture of what's going on. And the book is told in the voices of the people who live in Kazakhstan. And there's a whole section on politics, how Nursultan Nazarbayev has shaped Kazakhstan over 27 years of his rule, one-man rule, we could say. You know, a lot about, you know, how elections are held and how these have become real one-man show in Kazakhstan. 97% last time he was elected. And that's quite pertinent, of course, because there's a bit of chatter now about early elections possibly coming in Kazakhstan. And then there's also stories of history and identity of Kazakhstan. It's a complex country. Who are the Kazakhs? Who are the Russians? How did they get there? How do they all live together? How do they all feel about their place in modern day Kazakhstan and in the modern world too? And also some older people talking about the stories, incredible stories of Kazakh history. A woman who's now in her 90s told me how she walked to China at the age of six during the famine of the 1930s, a woman in her 70s deported at the age of 3 months from Chechnya. So lots of human tales as well. So a picture of Kazakhstan, I hope, over the last 25 years and beyond.
We wish you lots of success with the book, Joanna. And
So
talking about 2018, the book kind of pictures the entire history of independent Kazakhstan. So talking about 2018, what's the highlights that you will remember from Kazakhstan in 2018?
Well, from 2018, I mean, one thing I would single out in Kazakhstan, and I have to say it's not a highlight, is an increased clampdown on freedom of expression, which I think is really unfortunate. And it's not a positive trajectory for a country like Kazakhstan. You know, I think a lot of people who live there would like to see greater freedom of expression, not less freedom of expression after all these years. And by this, I mean, I'm talking about increased trials. Even over this autumn, this fall, we've seen several trials of people simply for expressing some complaints about social issues on social media or in Telegram, WhatsApp, these kind of messaging groups. And, you know, we've seen recently a man went to jail for 4 years for griping on social media. His name's Aset Abishev. And we're also seeing other people going to jail simply for, you know, expressing some gripes. And I think it's a shame to see the regime becoming more intolerant of criticism. criticism, you know, rather than more tolerant. And I think, you know, if the regime is so confident that Nursultan Nazarbayev is as popular as we are led to expect from a 98% vote in his favor in the last election, then I don't think they need to be that, you know, unconfident. I don't think they need to clamp down that much on ordinary people expressing their views. And it's also telling. Kazakhstan has no organized political opposition anymore and hasn't had for some years. And so the regime seems to go after ever smaller fry in its clamp down on dissent. And that, for me, that's what's characterized this year. And that, I think, is a shame.
Okay. Talking about 2018, the first thing that comes to my mind is the ongoing development in Uzbekistan. Though we are in the second year since the leadership change, but have we seen anything, Dr. Luka, this year, anything new, surprising, disappointing about Uzbekistan?
I am fascinated by what's happening there. I think it is the most important process that we have at the moment in Central Asia. I mean, alongside what Joanna was just saying, you know, this era of aging leadership in Kazakhstan. I think Uzbekistan is the big story there. And we talked about this a few times on the program. But I think that in 2018, we started to see what is the big picture. The picture is that, on the one hand, a process of authoritarian modernization, which is happening especially in so far as connectivity, regional connectivity, local connectivity, and economic development is concerned. So we have the Mirziyoyev presidency decided to open up Uzbekistan in a controlled fashion to foreign investors, to foreign visitors, to any kind of foreign influence, but it is controlled to the extent to which the first point I mentioned before has not dovetailed with a liberalization. We haven't heard any story about political pluralism. We haven't heard any story about allowing independent political parties. We haven't heard any serious discussion about what happened in the Karimov year. There hasn't been any kind of acknowledgement of the many problems that the prior regime had. So it is, if you want, a sweet and sour picture that we draw from Uzbekistan. One of course, very welcome opening of the borders, opening of bus routes, reopening of a connection with Kyrgyzstan and with Tajikistan, and things that make the life of ordinary Uzbek much better. That's an important thing. But on the other hand, we do have a trend that it's making this regime more presentable, but is still remaining very firm in the authoritarian field. I mean, hopefully in 2019, we will see how the government deals with the latter issue while continuing to deal with having the first of the core of their agenda. But for me, Uzbekistan 2018 is an alternation of highlights and lowlights.
Okay, talking of highlights and lowlights, I wanted to say Tajikistan, the rest aside, Bruce, the country has finally completed the Rogan Dam. Gosh, I thought it will never happen. So how much of development is this for Tajikistan or for Central Asia?
Well, Rogun, you know, I mean, you're right. This is a decades-old project that they've been working on here. It's still too early to tell, and we probably won't know for a little while. I mean, it finished, yes, in the sense that they have one unit power plant working, but there's still five more that they need to put online here, and they still need to build the retaining wall higher than it is. So it is something of an achievement after all this time. Not only is there questions about the, you know, when the completion of this, if it ever is completed and all six units are put in, you know, that's one question that I have about Rogun. Another one is financing, because Tajikistan is notorious for having these hydropower plants built and never being able to pay them off. Sangtuta 1 and Sangtuta 2 have never been money makers. So I don't know. Certainly, it will provide extra energy security for the country that they have this up there. But the other question, big question, and I know everyone here remembers, but when Brahman pitched this about not quite a decade ago, as being a real patriotic project, and everyone had to join in. I mean, they pretty much forced people to buy shares in this project. They were selling them outside movie theaters, mosques, all kinds of places. And so my question always was, now that we're done, if I was a Tajik citizen and I had 500 shares or whatever of this project that I was forced to buy, when can I cash my shares in?
What does it mean to me? You're right. Other than the dam, Bruce, there are a lot to discuss about Tajikistan. I think any progress on democracy or human rights appears to be on halt these days. So you just did a story. Tell us, please, if you were to choose one headline from 2018 other than the Rogan Dam, what that would be?
Tajikistan fastest to the bottom. without a doubt. I mean, they've been the bad story, not just of this year, but really of the last couple of years. Things have gone so bad, you know, that what grains of hope you could find in Tajikistan 5 years ago, you know, I mean, you could say, well, they got the only registered Islamic party, and there is something of a semi-independent media out there. I mean, some group outlets that are able to work more or less without too much interference or hindrance from the government, as long as they steer clear of certain topics. All this stuff is gone. You know, the government just cracked down. It's a family-run country. Any business that makes any money eventually ends up in the hands of someone in the president's family. You know, they've driven out opposition figures. They've driven out independent journalists. So it's the one that's deteriorated the most. You know, Turkmenistan has always been bad. So it's getting worse, but only because of the economy is getting worse. But it hasn't precipitously dropped the way Tajikistan has in the last few years. And it's becoming a really hopeless place. You know, it's been donor dependent. And I can't imagine that too many people are going to be anxious to invest in that country because of the climate there. So it's, for me, that was it's the most disappointing country in Central Asia. It's absolutely headed in the wrong direction.
Joanna, I will come back to you with a couple of questions on Kyrgyzstan. But before that, Dr. Lukaso, what's the biggest story of 2018 when it comes to Turkmenistan?
Well, the biggest story is that now the government is making no money for the export of its oil resource. And this is the main driver of the crisis that we've seen in the country for the last 4 or 5 years. And the biggest story this year, I think, has been the cancellation of the subsidies. That there was an extensive network of subsidies, free salt, free electricity, free gas, free water that the people were enjoying since independence. That was a cornerstone of the social pact that Niyazov made, was essential to Berdi Muhammadov emerging as the leader. In fact, if you read his first presidential speech, Berdi Muhammadov said that those subsidies would stay forever. Obviously, that is not going to be true because they were cancelled.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the key evolution of this year. We now have the government that despite, you know, its rhetoric on the golden age that Turkmenistan is experiencing, supposedly, they're now admitting indirectly that things are not that great, because the cancellation of subsidies has everything to do with the fall in revenues when it comes to the natural gas pumped through to the China-Turkmenistan pipeline. So 2018, it's another dark year for Turkmenistan. It's an year in which we do see the crisis becoming worse and worse on a daily basis. So I know that Bruce said that the bar was very low and it has been very low when it comes to Turkmenistan, but I think that this year we see the deterioration of the economic situation in the country.
Dr. Luca, looking into this from the bigger picture, you know, we knew that things are not going well there. Here in the Majlis, I think we spent our year guessing how bad can it get and what does it might mean to the country. And we, here we are. For some reason, I think we will continue to guess. Perhaps any self-criticism on our behalf that maybe our predictions were not as precise as the situation,
you know, I mean, Bruce and I are very much look at this with the same eyes, and we've been saying, you know, this can't go on forever. Well, it is going on for a long time, but I think that if we do analyze the evolution of the politics in the region over the long period, I mean, what's happening in Kazakhstan now? It is the result of Nazarbayev's ill decision not to run in 2011. That's a kind of regime watershed. He shouldn't have gone for the election in 2011. He did decide to go, and then things went downhill because the economy turned bad, because the journals and things like that. So everything is a long-term process. It is the same in Turkmenistan. There will be one day in the future, you know, and now, in which this situation will become unbearable. I thought that this moment would be closer rather than, you know, further down the track. I'd be wrong with that, you know, but I don't think that things can change drastically. I mean, we know because of what we read, because of what you guys report, because of the people that we speak with, that there is a big crisis. And we also know that the regime is not doing anything to address this issue. We haven't heard about the possibility of opening up upstream stake takes for Western companies in onshore, which will fix the issue straight away. So there is no reaction. The problem persists. The solution is not found. It's a waiting game. But you're right. I should be self, and I am self-critic. I've been wrong with that. But I don't think that things can go on like this forever.
Okay, Joanna, Kyrgyzstan. I think things are not yet fully over there. As always, it had a very active year in 2018. Presidential election, smooth transfer of power from one president to the other president, followed by disappointments and political divisions. So walk us through some of the headlines we will remember about Kyrgyzstan from 2018.
Well, I think what the biggest headline we can think of for Kyrgyzstan over this year has been the massive infighting and the power struggle that's been going on between the former president Atambayev and Jeenbekov, the president, who Atambayev believed would be a loyal successor to him. But instead, we've seen a massive outbreak of infighting, a power struggle, the arrest of two former prime ministers on corruption charges as Jeenbekov tries to get the upper hand. And clearly, what strikes me about this, two things, actually. The first thing is, Kyrgyzstan is and you can consider this a good thing or a bad thing, but Kyrgyzstan is the only country in our region where you see this kind of political fight playing out in public in the sort of Western style, where you see some combative politics, where you see politicians sort of struggling in this way for their position. But of course, what we're not seeing, it's not a fight about politics. It's merely a fight about power and position, and also in the true post-Soviet sense. You know, clearly Atambayev is afraid for his security. He's afraid that he may be tried himself on corruption charges, most likely. So in that sense, it's not about, you know, the fact that Kyrgyzstan has some kind of open political battle. It doesn't mean it's all about pure politics. There's still that element of post-Soviet score settling, let's say. And the other thing that strikes me is that I think that for many people, ordinary people, are weary of this kind of thing and would like to see their politicians actually tackling some of the serious problems that Kyrgyzstan, you know, faces, from poverty and unemployment that leads to mass migration that forces people to go look for work in Russia and elsewhere. They would like to see their politicians tackling this kind of thing. And there's one other headline from Kyrgyzstan this year that's kind of linked to that, perhaps. You know, the breakdown of the power plant in Bishkek at the beginning of the year when temperatures were minus 30. And this breakdown of a power plant that left people shivering in their homes in the capital also exposed some of the problems that Kyrgyzstan has failed to tackle over and over again. You know, we're talking about an opaque deal involving Chinese investor and repairs at the plant. And we're talking about people not having a say in how things are decided. And we're talking about, you know, potential for corruption, opacity in this kind of deals. Now, Kyrgyzstan likes to say that it's the only democracy in Central Asia. Well, the conduct of the last election that installed Jeenbekov cast much doubt on that assertion, because although it was competitive, you know, there was a great deal of pressure on the opposition, and the main opposition leader ended up fleeing Kyrgyzstan afterwards and quitting politics.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Joanna. So now, so what all this really mean? What I will try to do in the second half is that I have noted some of your points, so I will be asking what all this might mean going forward. Perhaps it is possible that I might have missed some of the points that you mentioned, so feel free to join me in asking questions to each other. But before doing so, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast, we are discussing highlights of 2018 in Central Asia and what some of the major developments might mean going forward in 2019. Joining me in the discussion are Joanna Lillis, Eurasia Net's Chief Central Asia Correspondent and author of the newly released book, Dark Shadows, Inside the Secret World of Kazakhstan, Lukan Cheschi, Central Asia Lecturer at the UK's University of Glasgow, Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlak Owazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Media Manager in Washington, D.C. And we are discussing highlights of 2018 in Central Asia and what it might mean for 2019. So, from the first stop. So we understood that freedoms are increasingly squeezed in Kazakhstan. Tajikistan, Bruce, you actually said that things are kind of disappointing there. And Turkmenistan's highlight is failing economy. And Uzbekistan, kind of positive story from 2018 when it comes to Central Asia. So on your point, maybe Bruce, let's start with you on Turkmenistan this time. So Turkmenistan's major economic projects, the TAPI pipeline and its Trans-Caspian pipeline dream, although there has been some changes in regards to Caspian Sea that we also discussed that in one of the Majlis episodes. So is it enough of a development, Bruce, to lead to any breakthrough, to anything good in 2019?
Wow, you know, neither one of those pipelines I see making much progress this year. But I'll just focus on the Caspian for a moment. The first thing I would say about that is that as far as the Trans-Caspian pipeline, you know, Berdimuhamedov doesn't talk about that very much, was already a bad sign. There was the first thing they need is for an agreement between Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan. And the way the Caspian Convention reads, actually, they have to deal with Iran on this to try to figure out where all their borders are. There's ecological concerns that have been raised by this Russian ambassador at large for the foreign ministry, who says that all the countries have to agree that it's safe before they can build it. But let's say that they all decide all these things. Then the problem becomes money. And President Aliyev said in August, when Merkel was in Azerbaijan, that if, you know, he would welcome the construction of the Trans-Caspian pipeline, he said Turkmenistan's got to put up money for this. You know, and he mentioned his own country and the state oil company Sokar as having contributed toward TANAP, the pipeline that runs through Turkey that's going to carry Azerbaijani gas. And so he made it clear that, you know, if Turkmenistan really wants to see this built, they're going to have to put in several billion dollars, or certainly a huge amount of money, to get the thing going. And we know that Turkmenistan's policy is not that, though. You know, TAPI is kind of an exception. But generally speaking, Turkmenistan says we'll build a pipeline to any part of our border. And if anyone builds a pipeline to that point, then, you know, they can use our gas. They don't say that they're willing to build past their border, which is what Aliyev says they have to do. So this is already a problem. You know, there have been some talks with the EU, but there have been for years. I don't see that there was a breakthrough that the EU was ready to start funding this any more than they ever were. So, you know, that leaves it to Turkmenistan to spend money, which, as Luca pointed out, they don't have. So I don't see this project going in 2019. I don't see that project going forward at all.
Luca, we understand that the economy in Turkmenistan is failing. Subsidized products were canceled this year, and no new idea is on the table. So what's that you will be looking in Turkmenistan, especially in regards to some of the challenges that the country has been facing in 2018 going forward next year in 2019?
Well, I think that we will hear more and more stories about food insecurity, both short term, you know, with the sudden unavailability of goods, so your primary food, and also longer term, you know, with having a much worse diet across the country, because there is no doubt that the population is getting poorer and poorer by the day. So that, I think, that would be the main story. I mean, a story that we will hear every month unless things change dramatically. Then I think that we should hear more about unrest. There is a regional tendency to be resilient. Population are very resilient, as we all know. But we hear more and more problems in Turkmenistan. A queue for foods are very common. We hear that the government is very much constraining internal movement of people in order not to have news of crisis spreading across the country. Do I expect to see the government changing its policies? No, I do not. They should do that, but they won't. Because it seems to me that they reached a comfortable point, and this is probably where I was wrong, you know, before. I never thought it would get there. I think they reached a comfortable point in getting enough money from the revenues to support their own patronage network, the non-transparent means, and also they using, you know, different projects for, you know, infrastructure projects to feed off corruption networks. And, you know, we've seen that with the airports, with the freeway between Ashgabat and Avaza, the six lanes each way. We've seen that with the games, the Asian games, or the Indoor games. So we've seen that there is this tendency of sort of siphoning off the money for non-transparent purposes. And to me, that's the thing that we're seeing our noise.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Luca. So, Joanna, among this group, you are the only one who been to Uzbekistan since the leadership changed there. So President Mirziyayev shook up the country quite a bit in the first quarter of this year, but lately he's kind of quiet no more head spinning changes, to put it plainly. So any hand as to what is coming up in 2019? Do you think we will be more clear as to where is this country headed going forward?
I think we will. I think one of the problems for Mizioyev is that he certainly hit the ground running when he took over from Karimov in late 2016, so 2 years ago, with a lot of reform ideas, a big reform agenda, a lot of eye-catching initiatives. All of them perhaps positive. And these also, to some degree, I think these did also capture the imagination of people in Uzbekistan who, even if the reforms were limited in some ways, as pointed out by earlier speakers, Luka, I think, mentioned no plurality of political parties, no prospect of free elections. All of that is true. But still, it captured people's imagination. And even a little bit of the loosening of the screws was viewed positively by people and allowed them to breathe a little bit more freely. Going forward into 2019, I think there's a danger for Mizioyev that he could, you know, run out of momentum, maybe not in 2019, maybe later. It's only easy to announce big ticket reforms, to announce them, to have the ideas, but it's quite hard to see all this through and to deliver real impact in terms of people's daily lives, in terms of the economic transformation that he wants to wreak, liberalizing the economy, bringing investment, creating jobs, making, you know, improving GDP, putting more money in people's pockets. Now, all of that is very, very difficult to deliver. And I think, you know, that's when it's going to get difficult. At the moment, he has so much goodwill. I think that's true among ordinary people as well as among the international community.
Yeah, I think that one of the major tests might be coming very soon, Bruce. We were talking about earlier about the upcoming parliamentary elections in Uzbekistan. So that's something that you are closely looking at. So what is that you think might be coming up in Uzbekistan? 2019.
Well, as far as those elections, I mean, this is going to be a hard sell for you know, Western governments that want to see Uzbekistan in a more favorable light, because they're not going to register any other political parties, and people in the government made no comments about even allowing independents to run. So we're going to have the same four parties run for the same amount of seats, and I imagine they'll still, while they might tone down their pro-presidential rhetoric, it will still be there. So everyone will see it for what it is, which is just basically, you know, another to elect another rubber stamping parliament. It'll be a disappointment that, and Luke had already mentioned that there's a real big difference between economic reform and domestic political reform in Uzbekistan. And this will show that they're not ready to move forward on that at all. And if you're hoping for some kind of democratic reform in Uzbekistan, I think a lot of people are going to be disappointed with that.
Joanna, let me come back to you. You know, one of the developing stories in Central Asia has to do with China. Central Asians are increasingly frustrated with Chinese crackdown in Xinjiang, which has been slowly expanding on ethnic groups that have blood connection to Central Asia. So we just did a Majlis podcast, and you were not in that. But after the show, we learned that China allowed around 2,000 Kazakhs to leave the country since January this year, which means that they were kept there, I believe, against their will. And this number doesn't include the ones who are in the so-called re-education camps. And now Kyrgyz activists are up in arms against what they say is the Chinese persecution of ethnic Kyrgyz. Some of them are citizens of Kyrgyzstan. So we still yet to know number of Kyrgyzstani citizens affected by this. So, and very lately, Uzbek scholars have been petitioning the president, highlighting the persecution of Uzbeks in Xinjiang. So I don't know what is next, but what would you be looking for in 2019? Is it something like, is there something big cooking up there?
This is definitely going to run into 2019 and most likely beyond. As we heard in your Majlis discussion last week, the issue was first raised in 2017, but it's really gained ground over this year and started to be really strongly raised in Kazakhstan among activists and among, you know, some ordinary people. And it's also, you know, started to be raised in other countries, as you mentioned. Now, what we're not going to see clearly is the Chinese admitting that there is a problem or closing the camps. I mean, they have acknowledged the existence of the camps under intense pressure from the international community, but they have described them as vocational training centers rather than re-education camps or concentration camps, which we could also call them. But they have made it clear that they don't feel any regret about incarcerating minorities in them. So they're clearly not going to close them. There is pressure in Kazakhstan where pressure first emerged, actually. Mm. And I think that pressure's not going to go away. There are certain activist groups that have been created specifically involving Kazakhs who come from China or have relatives in China who are in camps. And that also there is some concern among Kazakh-born Kazakhs who've heard about this problem. I think, you know, it's a very difficult question, because for the government, taking on China, such a powerful neighbor and such a rich neighbor where economic cooperation is deeply entwined, is very problematic. And it's not the Kazakh nature to be confrontational. I mean, in terms of the government's foreign policy, and I don't think they will start to be confrontational. From Kazakhstan's point of view, what we're seeing is the government saying it's working quietly behind the scenes to try to resolve some of the issues. And one of those, the results the government has told us, is that they've managed to get 2,000 people, Kazakhs, subject to travel bans, being able to travel. I don't know whether this could lead to protests in Kazakhstan. It's possible. I wouldn't say it's particularly likely, given the government's habit of cracking down heavily on protests. But I think what we can say is it's going to run and run. And the fact that these concerns are now spreading to Kyrgyzstan and possibly to Uzbekistan means that the issue will not go away. And I think what people will be hoping for, activists, is that pressure from the international community, from the West, will encourage China to rein in its policies to some degree.
Okay, still staying with Kazakhstan, Luca and Bruce, you guys have been projecting a possible imminent transition of power there, but Nazarbayev resisted in 2018. So, Luca, is it might be on the cards in 19? What's your projection?
Well, there are more and more rumors about an election, a snap election, which is not really snap, because Kazakhstan got a regular tradition of bring them forward. So I am not sure. I mean, Joanna for sure knows more than me about this. But for me, this is part of a long-term process. I mean, Bruce and I wrote that, a couple of years ago now, Bruce, I think that we wrote that piece together in which we said that, you know, the Sagintayev-Maximov team will be the team that leads the transition. It seems to me that on that account, we were right, because we haven't really heard of any kind of loss of power of these two individuals there. What to me is interesting is the fact that Kazakhstani politics is frozen on time. I mean, there are important developments, but it's now becoming like Uzbekistan. Everyone is waiting for this big event to happen, and there is this kind of sense that there will be the zero hour in which Nazarbayev will go, either by his own will or just because he will die in power, which seems to be the regional trend. I have been working on succession in the last couple of years in Central Asia, working on Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan. And it seemed to me that given that there is a tradition of authoritarian alignment, so they copy each other when it comes to their politics, I would be surprised if this transition wasn't already arranged in a way that would generate the same smooth arrangement that we've seen in the regional kind of force. Kazakhstan is a bigger polity. Kazakhstan's elite is more sophisticated. There are significant business interests there, more than the other countries. So things could be a little bit more complex to organize. But I think that we still are in this period in waiting, in which there is a president who has been, for good or for bad, a crucially important figure in the history of the country, but is now in his twilight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bruce, your thoughts on Kazakhstan, and also talking about leadership change. This is also has been in the pipelines or maybe on the agenda in Tajikistan, at least some say it is. So what's the one biggest development you are looking at in Tajikistan in 2019?
Well, there has been talk that Rahmon might actually leave office. But the next presidential election's in 2020 and hand it over to his son. They've been certainly preparing the soil for this in Tajikistan for a while. I'm still skeptical that Rustam Emomali is anybody that you would want to have as a president. But certainly he'll be, 31 or 32, I guess 32 next year, at the end of next year. So it's still pretty young to be president. I know they changed the constitution. He can get in, you know, legally anyway, he could run and be elected president. But there's going to be a lot of people. And I suppose as long as his dad is alive, he might be able to pull it off. But I think when his father dies, I can't imagine that he would much of a president. And he would probably have a lot of people coming after him immediately. But my guess would be that Emomali Rahmon would want to stay on for at least another term. But Tajikistan's politics are a bit, you know, I mean, pretty much eliminated almost all the opposition. There is still one party anyway that's operating there, but they're small. They have no chance in any of these elections, certainly not in a presidential election. So you know, it's, I don't see much hope for anything positive coming through elections in that country. Even if they did have a transition of power, it would be a dynastic transition of power, not really a political transition. So,
So you see no change in Kazakhstan?
Well, that's different. Clearly something happened. You know, Jaxibekov getting the boot in September was something happened there, and I'm not really sure what. You know, there's some people say, well, you know, his son made such a mess out of the bank that he was running that Nazarbayev had to do something, and so he let Jaxibekov go, and he's going to clean up the mess that his son made. But, you know, this business of saying publicly that it's time for him to go into retirement 1 year after he'd exempted him from retirement, this is a powerful figure in the country, and people like that don't just fall suddenly without something going on behind the scenes that we didn't see.
Yeah.
So I would say that for me anyway, that was a sign that somebody's getting prepared for the transition of leadership soon in Kazakhstan, and they wanted this one guy out of the way right away. And I think, and I know me and Luca have talked about this before too, but I think the closer we get, you have to look at any changes in the Kazakh government, any serious high positions, you have to link that with the coming transition of power.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. We have to conclude the discussion here. But one final point, Joanna, from you. So Kyrgyzstan, so what's your best guess where things are headed there in 2019? Who will survive the battle of presidents? Even the bigger question is, what do you expect to be the big story of 2019 in Kyrgyzstan?
Well, the question of who will survive the battle of presidents is a good one. I think, I think obviously J.M. Bekov, the incumbent, has all the tools at his disposal to win the battle. I mean, he's the one in power. He's the one with control over the security forces, with control over all the levers of power. But Atambayev's not going down without a fight, and this has the potential to keep causing instability. I mean, quite clearly, it can keep causing instability and keep distracting J.M. Bekov from the real business of ruling. As for what's going to be the big story in Kyrgyzstan, I mean, I think we have to hope that it will be a positive story, but I think we can probably expect more of the same. We can expect more infighting. We can expect perhaps more corruption scandals that we keep on seeing, and we can keep on seeing all this unless there's going to be, you know, a real focus by the government on actual reform. I think it's unfortunate that Kyrgyzstan has under J.M. Bekov actually has, you know, really consolidated its what was happening under Atambayev, where really it's all paying lip service now to being the only democracy, the only parliamentary democracy in Central Asia. As I said before, it's got a more vibrant political scene. It has a sort of politics taking place in a way we don't see in other countries. But what we're not seeing is any sort of consolidation of democracy. We're not seeing any consolidation of that of parliamentary democracy that the Kyrgyz like to tout. And I would like to hope that we could see some kind of success story on that front, on the political front in 2019. But to be honest, I doubt it, because J.M. Bekov has pinned his colors to the mask, and what he wants is control.
You know, if I could just throw in before we leave Kyrgyzstan, that if the Omar Beks return to politics, Tekibayev and Babanov, it would it could make this a lot more interesting a year, 2019, because they'll jump.
Definitely.
Babanov might come back soon, and there's been talk of letting Tekibayev out, and that will shift the political alliances in the country.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Shlok Owozi. And also big thanks goes to Joanna Lillis, your Asianet's chief Central Asia correspondent and author of the newly released book, Dark Shadows Inside the Secret World of Kazakhstan, and Dr. Lukan Cheschi, Central Asia lecturer at the UK's University of Glasgow and author of a book on Turkmenistan's neutrality. Thank you, colleagues, for your thoughts and times today.
Thank you.
And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.